is January 2026. Can you even believe we are in 2026? It's Becky Brown with your Club New Life Collective. We are looking at a new year in front of us, and it can feel daunting sometimes. But I was laughing because Rhonda Sonnenberg gave me a little poem that says, 2026, a fix is in the mix. I wonder what you will work on this year. What do you need to build a better future in 2026? Well, New Life is here to help you. And I know that we are so excited to see where God's going to take you in the new year, and we want to be part of it. We have some new things that will be coming in the new year, and we have something special on the horizon for you who already stand with us at New Life. We're going to invite people to be part of what God is doing through New Life, and we want to share the news, but it's coming, so stay tuned. One area in our lives that seems to roll around often is the need to forgive and repair a situation with a friend, a coworker, or a family member. Mark Cameron recently shared at our Club New Life Zoom gathering ways to work through conflicts. This and many of our past Zoom teachings are available on our website. Let's listen as Mark shares on forgiveness and repair.
You guys may have heard of John and Julie Gottman. So John and Julie Gottman, they are psychologists. And for the last 50 years, they have been studying couples. They've studied thousands and thousands of couples. And what they found is that the most successful couples are not the ones who avoid conflict. They're actually the ones who know how to repair. So that they know how to speak up. They know how to address something. And they know how to come back together and talk about it. Because when you come back together and you talk about something that has hurt you, because repair separates us, it causes a break in the relationship. But when you come back and you learn how do we talk about this productively in a healthy way, it actually restores the relationship and can help bring you closer together. So now, stress and conflict, they're not necessarily a sign of failure in a relationship. Disagreement actually shows a level of comfort to be able to express differences in a relationship. The absence of conflict isn't necessarily a sign of a healthy relationship. Stress is a normal part of life, and it's the messy part of relationships. We can't get away from stress. We have stress all the time. You may have had stress this morning trying to log on to the Zoom and had technical difficulties, or we have stress in traffic, or we have stress at home. And in relationships, we have stress too. So we can't get away from stress. We need to really know and learn how to manage stress. And when we can talk about stress in relationships, we can have a depth to that relationship. And no two people are alike in exactly the same way. We're going to have disagreement. And disagreement shows that there's a comfort to express difficulties in a relationship. So conflict, stress is inevitable. Conflict is inevitable. But how do you handle conflict? Now, you may have heard me talk about attachment styles on the broadcast. And so attachment is programming. It's the programming that we get on relationships from our families that we grow up in. That bond that we have with each of our parents forms something called an attachment style, which is our relational style. And that programs us for our expectations in relationships, but it also programs us for our stress responses. Now, people who are pleasers and victims, they freeze or fawn. You probably heard of these fight, flight, or freeze, which is our stress responses. So pleasers and victims, they freeze or they fawn. Fawning is giving in to the other person. Avoiders, emotional avoiders, they tend to shut down, waiting for the conflict to blow over, or they distance it or leave. They go work on the car in the garage, they go spend time at the gym, they stay longer at work. They've learned that, you know, I get over it myself and I'm just going to wait for the other person to get over it. And then vacillators and controllers, they are the pursuers in a conflict. They want to fight. They go to a fight response. And really for them, conflict really is about winning. But when conflict is approached with care, it can actually deepen connection. It gives us the chance to see whether others love us enough to forgive us after making a mistake, and if they can offer grace and stay connected with us despite our flaws. And it helps us be able to do the same too. So healthy disagreement, it allows that space for us to explore differences, to build trust, and it also reveals our blind spots. We all have blind spots, and we need people to give us feedback and speak into our lives to show us. You know, if I've got something on my face, if I've got something in my teeth, I need a friend to be able to tell me, hey, you've got something there in your teeth because I can't see that. And so when somebody gives us feedback in a loving way, it actually holds up a mirror to us in our lives, and it allows us to be able to address something that is there that we are not aware of. So it gives us the opportunity to grow. And so we all need people like this in our lives, people who can challenge us in love, and people who are brave enough to disagree with us and still stay close to us. Those folks play a unique and essential role in our lives because they can do this. Now, not all disagreement needs to result in conflict, but it often does. Now, I want you to think back to the last conflict that you had, and I want you to think about how did that resolve? Did you move on without a conversation? When we move on without true resolution, pain just doesn't disappear. It gets stored up for the next event, and then the next event ends up being compounded by that pain, and it comes out even harder. Did you have a conversation to talk about the conflict that you had? And in that conversation, did both parties get heard out in a productive way, or did one person just get to spill out and tell all of their hurts? And then was there an apology in there? Now, what did you learn about repair in your family of origin? That's what FOO stands for. So we all learned a way to repair or not repair. And as I said, attachment is relationship programming. So in our families of origin, we learn certain things about repair and rupture. Now, I want you to think about, did you see rupture, relational rupture, that's a conflict and repair model well, in the sense of somebody had a disagreement. You know, maybe it didn't go well in the disagreement, but then they came back and they talked through it, and there was a true apology and there was true forgiveness. And at the end of that, both parties felt closer to one another. So I want you just to kind of think about this. What did that look like in your home? Maybe you grew up and you didn't see rupture between your parents. Now, oftentimes this seems like this is the desired model, especially for a Christian home. Often what we're taught is we don't have arguments. Parents have discussions, and they have those discussions behind closed doors, away from the kids. The kids don't see any kind of conflict happen. They're in, you know, I heard someone tell me recently, you know, she knew her parents talked about things because she could hear them from her bedroom when she went to sleep. She didn't know anything about what happened in those conversations. So if you didn't see rupture or repair between your parents, then you don't grow up with a model for what to do, because as I said, all relationships have rupture. Maybe your home had frequent rupture, but no repair. There was a blow up. Someone in the household got really angry and blew up, and everybody walked on eggshells around them for a little while. And then all of a sudden, they were just okay again, and everybody else had to recover. You just had to get over it. Or were you forced to apologize to either a sibling or a parent? Oftentimes, we teach kids how to apologize by putting little Sally and little Jimmy in front of one another, and we say, okay, you say sorry, and now you say sorry, right? And it's kind of really one of these, and they just say sorry, right? And that's okay for the parents, and then we let them walk away, and they both walk away this way. But that's not really an apology. No, neither of them actually feel sorry inside, and neither of them actually feel like they've actually offered forgiveness or feel better about it. So that may have been your experience. Now, as I said, rupture is inevitable. And whenever we have rupture, we need to have repair to make things right again. Repair is that opportunity to build intimacy by restoring the relationship. And if you think about it, the gospel is a story about rupture and repair. We had a rupture with the divine right at the beginning in the Garden of Eden. And Jesus was the rescue plan. That was the repair plan to give us a way to get back into relationship with God. He sent his son to make a way for us to get back into that. So while repair is optional, it is vital. And so, if apologies are done right, then relationships can heal actually stronger than before. But if they're done wrong, they deepen the rupture. And when they're done wrong, it's things like saying, I'm sorry, but, right? That's not a great way to start an apology. It's not even a good way to start an apology because whenever we say, I'm sorry, but, a criticism or a justification or an excuse usually follows. And that often negates the apology for the other person. So I'm going to give you here five A's of a good apology. Okay, so you can see what does a good apology look like. These are the five elements, and I've put them into five A's to make them really easy to remember here. Okay, so here's the first A. The first A is admit. Now, don't just say sorry. You have to admit specifically what you did wrong, right? You have to show the other person that you recognize what caused the rupture or what caused the hurt in the other person. So that might look like, I'm sorry for raising my voice and shutting down. So specifically say what it is that you did wrong. Next A is ask. Ask how your actions impacted the other person. Don't just say sorry or I'm sorry for yelling and then just expect the whole thing to be over. We need to ask the other person, what was their experience in this? How did that affect you? They need to be able to share what went on with them. You know, if your anger was scary, they need to be able to share that it was scary to me in that moment. The third A is acknowledge. Acknowledge their feelings. We need to be able to show something called a validation and empathy. Now, validation is a statement that says it makes sense why you felt that way. Saying something like, I understand why you felt hurt. That makes sense. And then empathy is a statement that shows the impact of that emotion on the other person. So saying, that must have been really difficult for you when you felt scared like that. So that's an empathetic statement. And then we need to amend if needed. You know, if I borrow Becky's car and I get into an accident, I can't just return it to her and say, oh, I'm sorry, I had a fender bender. Please forgive me. I need to make that right somehow. I need to, you know, she's got a broken car now. I've got to go and I've got to offer to pay for that to be fixed, or I've got to use my insurance to make her whole again. And then the last thing is accountability. We can't just keep on messing up, and we will keep on messing up to a certain degree because we are sinners. But when we keep doing the same thing, the same hurt to someone over and over and again, and we just keep apologizing and we don't have an accountable plan of how to fix it, it starts to feel hopeless for the other person that okay, we're just going to keep on doing what we're doing. So we need to be accountable. We need to be able to make a strong commitment to hold ourselves accountable in the future to not make the same mistake again. You know, if we don't do that, it's not really a useful apology if we don't include those other things. So we've got to be able to overcome shame in order to be able to do that. And the other person's got to be able to buy into that plan. And maybe we need to even offer the other person a way to show us. Like, when you're scary, I want you to know that it's okay for you to say these words to me. I often give people words and phrases in therapy. And it's okay to say something along the lines of, like, I can see that you're upset about this and that this conversation is important to you, but I'm not willing to argue. So I'm going to take a break and I'll be back in 20 minutes and we can try again. And we need to give other people permission to be able to say those things to us. So that's the repair part. But what about forgiveness? Because some people on this call, you've suffered really horrible abuse. You've been bullied, you've been manipulated, you've had unfair treatment from people. Some of you have had crimes against you. What about that? Betrayal. And so forgiveness isn't simple, but it is possible. There is a way, and I'm going to show you the way. So now you probably heard the story in Matthew 18. Jesus tells a story about forgiveness, and his story basically is, and some of it is lost on us because we don't understand the currency definitions. But the servant who owed the master money it was billions of dollars. It was actually an amount of money that could not be repaid. He owed the king 10,000 talents. Now, one single talent was worth 20 years of a day laborer's wages. So, an average person's wages was one talent. He owed the king 10,000 talents. And basically, what Jesus was saying, it was an impossible sum to pay. He could not pay that back. Even over 100 years, he probably could not pay that back. And then the king was merciful, and when he asked for forgiveness and he begged, he forgave the servant. And then the servant goes out and he meets a fellow servant who owes him 100 denarii. Now, a denarius was usually a daily wage, as I said. So this other person owed a significant amount of money. It's about 5 months' worth of wages. So it was a decent amount of money, not enough that he wanted to forget about. But remember, he'd just been forgiven billions, billions. And you know the story. He has that person thrown into prison until that person can pay back, right? And so what's the message? The message to us is we forgive because we've been forgiven. Now, in Luke 7:47, Jesus says, "He who has been forgiven much loves much." Now, I don't know if you guys know this band. They're called Reliant K, and they're from very close to where Becky is in Ohio. And they're a Christian band. They're a punk Christian band. They're one of my favorite bands, and they have a song. And one of the lines in the song says, "The beauty of grace is that it makes life unfair." And that's totally true. And, you know, when my kids were little, not to agitate them, but when they would say life is unfair, I would say, but I love that life is unfair because if life was fair, then I would have to pay the price. I would have to go to hell. And I love that life isn't fair because I don't have to do that. So now, forgiveness. Okay, so forgiveness can be hard when something really hurtful has happened to you to be able to say, well, you know what, I just feel like forgiving the other person. That is not easy here. Forgiveness, though, is a process. It's not an event. Like love, forgiveness is much an action as it is a healing. Now, there's a professor called Everett Worthington. He's a clinical psychologist, and he has done extensive work on forgiveness research, and he's come up with these two concepts that he's observed: decisional forgiveness and emotional forgiveness. So decisional forgiveness is deciding to forgive, versus the feeling, the emotional feeling of feeling like forgiving. Now, some of you may know who Corrie ten Boom is. She and her sister, she was Dutch, and she and her sister and her whole family were imprisoned and went to Ravensbrück, Nazi concentration camp for hiding the Jews. And her sister was tortured, so was she. Her sister died in the camp, and Corrie was actually released by a clerical error, but she was a Christian. And after the war, she went around and she preached forgiveness. And one day after one of her forgiveness talks, one of her crusades, there was a line of people coming up to her. And in the line, she saw one of the guards who was particularly cruel to her sister. And this line was coming up to shake her hand, and she saw him and she said to God, "God, I cannot forgive this person." And he came up to her and he offered his hand and he said, "I'm so thankful for forgiveness, sister." And she said, "The Lord said something to her. You can do it." And she said she realized that forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. So what she was talking about was decisional forgiveness. She didn't feel like it, but she chose to do it. And one study shows that it takes on average 18 efforts of decisional forgiveness before that emotional forgiveness follows. So just because we say we forgive someone, even though we don't feel like it, that's actually part of the process. And so Everett Worthington came up with this easy acronym to remember, and it's called REACH. R is for recall. We remember the hurt that was done to us as objectively as we can. So we try and give grace. We think about someone's intention behind it, so as objectively as we can. And then we empathize. We try and understand the viewpoint of the person who wronged us. Now, what were they thinking? What was their experience? You know, even given their history in life, you know, what they've gone through, why might they see that that was okay, that action? And then A is for altruism. We think about a time that we hurt someone and we were forgiven. And then we use that memory to offer the gift of forgiveness to the person who hurt us. And now C is for committing, because that hurt generally comes back and we replay it in our head. So we've got to commit. We publicly forgive the other person who's wronged us. And that could be even just telling a friend, you know, "I forgive this person who has hurt me." And then H is for holding on. We don't forget the hurt, but we remind ourselves that we made that choice to forgive. Now, Everett Worthington talks about something called an injustice gap, right? The injustice gap is, the hurt that I suffered and, the repair that has been made here. And he notes that research reveals that the difficulty of forgiving is directly related to the size of the perceived injustice gap. But that gap can be reduced when we offer sincere apologies or we make amends. Because when we do that, we restore some sense of justice for the person to thinking about the offense that was caused. Now, Lewis B. Smedes, who is a theologian, he said this, and you may have heard this quote before, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and then realize that the prisoner was you. So why are we the prisoner? Because when we don't forgive, we have bitterness and we have resentment, and that eats up inside of us. And so when we forgive, we learn to release someone else from that. So apologizing for our mistakes actually frees us. It allows us to find healing, right? The gospel says that, we will be forgiven. Jesus taught us how to pray as we forgive others. And so that's how what he wants us to do. But forgiveness also changes our brain. When we forgive, we can't forget, forgive and forget. It's not really true. We don't really forget. But what we do is we create a new way to remember. Lewis B. Smedes says, forgiving what we cannot forget creates a new way to remember. We change the memory of our past into a hope for the future. So what does this mean? Well, when we think of a memory, it's not like in the movies. It's not like we replay, in the movies when we watch somebody who recalls an event, a movie replays and the exact same thing happens. But that's not how our brains work. When we forgive, we think about the last time that we remembered the event. So as we choose to forgive each time we think about the event, we remember the forgiveness that we offered. And if the other person has offered amends, they've made things right, they've offered apologies, they've taken accountability, we feel better about that over time. So even though we might not forget what happened to us, it changes the way that we think about the hurt. It changes that association. It removes or it dampens the trigger. And so, again, you can see it's as much for our benefit as the one who's being forgiven. And then there's that quote that I showed you, Matthew 6, 14 to 15. For if you forgive other people when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their sins, your Father will not forgive you. So Jesus shows this scale in here. But again, it's not about being punitive. He knows that when we forgive, it heals us and it repairs us. And, if you think about it, when we take communion, what are we doing? Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me, in memory of me, right? And so when we forgive and we take communion, we remember that Christ died on the cross, not us, right? And that helps us forgive. And so that's a way to change our brain here.
Many of our listening family have adult sons and daughters who have a difficult time adulting. How do we as parents encourage our young adults to gain a greater understanding of themselves and to find direction for their lives, to empower them, and to do it without triggering them? Our first call addresses just that. Mark Cameron and Jim Burns will be addressing Susie, who called about her 22-year-old son's choices on how he spends his time. Following that call, Dr. Jackie Mack Harris and Dr. Alice Benton encourage Anne, who's facing parental alienation and desires to reconnect. After that, we'll have two short teachings. J.J. West will share on belonging, and Mark Cameron will talk about depression.
Quick, let's go to Rapid City, South Dakota.
No pun intended.
No pun intended whatsoever. Susie, listening on Sirius XM channel 131. Welcome to New Life Live.
Hi.
Hi, how can we help you today?
I'm just calling in because we have an adult son that is, he's a good kid. He's got a great job, but he comes home in between his work schedule and stays here and he doesn't participate. He just sleeps or plays video games. We've asked him sometimes to help or to do different things and I don't know, just doesn't want to participate. And we just don't really know like what to do with him. I've told him, you know, you don't seem happy here, and you seem angry when you're here, and it's kind of spilling over into the rest of the family. Why don't you find your own place or that sort of thing? And he gets angry and but doesn't do anything about it. So I don't know what to do.
How old is he, Susie, and what's his job?
He's 22 years old, and he's an electrician at a coal mine. So he makes really good money. So he has a strange schedule. Like he works three nights, 12-hour shifts, and then have a day or two off, and then he'll have to work like 4 days, have 12-hour shifts. So he's tired when he gets home, but and I understand that, but it's, sometimes he'll have a week off, and he won't do anything but sleep or play video games.
And when you say he doesn't participate and he gets angry, what are your expectations of the things that he should be participating in, and what does his anger look like?
Participation, just, I don't know. He comes to eat when we say the dinner's ready, but he doesn't necessarily help clean up. He doesn't participate or offer to, you know, help usually in getting ready. I mean, we do live on a ranch, so there's always things going on, and we've said, you know, hey, we could use some help with this or use some help with that, and he doesn't want to unless we say, we really need you, then he'll show up. So, I don't know, just I guess we're, as him being home as an adult, just seems like he should.
Do you charge him rent or anything?
No. Mm-mm. Because we never thought in a million years that he would be, like, doing this still. I mean, he has a crash pad over there at the mine that he stays at when he's working his 12-hour shifts. But that's all it is. You know, he just sleeps there, and then he doesn't actually live there.
Right.
Yeah, so he is an adult, but he's a young adult. And actually, I learned this term from Jim's book here. He's a transitional adult. So he's still transitioning. And so, yeah, he's not a child anymore, but he's still living at home. So he's still somewhat dependent upon you. And you know, what we know from neuroscience is actually the adult brain doesn't fully, completely develop until the mid-20s, and for males, late 20s. And so biologically, it's not that necessarily that we are, you know, we don't have adult responsibilities, but biologically, you know, we're in adolescence, you know, so to speak, until that time. And so it sounds like, you know, he's probably ready for you, even if he wouldn't admit it, to kind of challenge him to the next level of adulthood, which could be either charging him rent or encouraging him to move out or requiring him to engage in certain activities, certain chores and things like that. And especially if he's living at home and he's mistreating you in his anger, his irritation, I mean, that's not okay. I mean, the next, our job as parents is to, and I have, you know, young adult, you know, I would say, you know, lightly quote unquote, because they're 20, right? After what I'm telling you here, young adult
kids. They're telling
kids.
You they're adults.
Right, exactly. But they are still dependent. Sure. And not just, you know, financially, but emotionally too. And I find myself that I have to, you know, challenge them and call them out in different ways. And my son no longer lives with us. But, you know, at some point, you know, you do have to kind of launch kids. And if they won't launch, you have to challenge them to launch. And you got to kind of push them, so to speak, somewhat out of the door so that they can learn to stand on their feet. And so that might be the next level for you. What holds you back from asking him to leave, or charging him rent, or maybe even having that conversation of, hey, listen, we love you, we care about you, we get you got a hard job and you need to come home and relax. But when you come home and you're irritable, like, that's not okay. What holds you back?
I guess the part of that we've just kind of accepted it was that, you know, just growing up, he's always challenged us and been one that didn't really want to participate and didn't really want to help. So we kind of ignored it. And it's like, well, maybe he'll grow out of it. And so I did challenge him recently, and I just pointed out, I mean, he goes through waves of being frustrated, and then we go through waves of, like, you know what, it's just him. He's just that way. Just let it go. And if you don't rock the boat, then he's not angry, really. He just does his thing and we do our thing, but it doesn't seem healthy. And we also have a 18-year-old that lives here that gets really, really upset because he sees his older brother seemingly take advantage of us, and that just really frustrates him. And so the whole atmosphere in the house when the 22-year-old is home gets tense and, you know, not a healthy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll let Jim...
I don't know. I guess I just need to challenge him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll let Jim jump in a minute because he's somewhat of an expert on this. But here's what I would say to you. I did an opening on this actually several months ago. It could even be a year ago on eagles. Eagles actually make the nest uncomfortable for the young eaglet. After a while, as they get old enough, they actually start to pull some of the fur and the fluff out to expose some of like the thorniness. And then they'll even like take the food that they bring back and they'll put it on a different branch. So the eaglet has to go out and get the food. And if the eaglet falls to the ground, they actually don't go and rescue the eaglet. They still bring the eaglet food, but they leave the eaglet on the ground and until it grows mature enough out of necessity.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. That's
Lessons
a great illustration.
Nature. Yeah.
That is a great illustration.
That's on page 89 in his book.
No, I'm telling you. I love that. I actually think, Susie, that this is a great opportunity for you. The bottom line in parenting with your adult child is that you want them to be a responsible adult. So if we constantly enable them toward dependency on us, then what that happens is they become entitled and they don't become responsible adults. I mean, he's got a great deal right now. You know, he comes home when he wants and he plays video games when he wants and he does whatever he wants and he doesn't help you guys out. I'm going to suggest not in the heat of the battle. So again, you can always have the heat of the battle, but in the heat of the battle that you have a really good conversation with him and you almost recognize him to be a man. I worked for an organization and spoke for an organization called Promise Keepers. And the president of it used to say all the time, he would say, a man is not a man until you tell him he is. And so you want to treat him now like a man. So you have to reinvent the relationship, give him the passport to adulthood. And what you say is, now that you are an adult, let's talk about how we can best do this. And again, I'm not putting this on your brother because he's not yet an adult, but he's close. And then give exactly what Mark said. I think you either give him some expectations that are, he has a full-time job, sure, but you all work too. So, since you're working, what we're going to ask is that you help with and be don't just go help. Say you're going to help by doing the dishes twice a week. I'm making this up, obviously. You're in a ranch. You're going to help with this or that. But things he can do, things he's already done. Sometimes he's rolled his eyes, but here's what we're expecting. However, because you're an adult, if you choose to, go get a place, maybe we can even help you with, it sounds like he has money, but maybe we can even help you with the first month rent a little bit, or we'll do whatever. Mm-hmm. And we realize the negative to that, but we also realize the positive. Or like we did this with our daughter, we actually, when she came back, and there was a little of that with her, we charged her, and we actually charged her $100 a month. So it was not going to change her life. She'd already had a apartment and the girl she was with moved. And we just took the money. We put it aside. And when she left after 2.5 years, it was a 2-month deal, but it became 2.5 years. Yeah. We gave her the money. And, and she goes, what, huh? I think she thought it was kind of weird that we charged her the rent, but we just thought we're going to help her by being responsible, even in a small way. So I think what you're talking about is reinventing the relationship for you. He doesn't know how to be an adult and you don't know how to parent an adult. No, we just don't. None of us do. So you give him those expectations. How he handles those expectations will help him become a responsible adult.
All right. Let's talk to Anne in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, listening on WRGN. Harrisburg. Jackie Mac Harris is here. So this is perfect. How you doing, Anne?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for taking my call, and Merry Christmas to all.
Oh, thanks. You too, Anne.
Thank you. I have a situation concerning parental alienation. I'll keep it brief. I divorced a cheating man in 2008. I single-handedly raised 3 daughters into adulthood with college, 2 marriages, etc. And the second wedding 3 years ago, I was invited to, but I was not included in a response for the rehearsal time, the rehearsal dinner, and they stopped talking to me at that wedding. Ooh. And it has been excruciating. Wow. I'm trying to do my best, not just because of the holiday, but thank you for letting me get this call through.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Any tips?
So something happened around the second wedding. They invited you, but did not include you in the planning. Have there been difficulties over the years? Have your children felt controlled by you?
They felt very pulled by both of us. I was the solid, non-fun parent who provided, and Dad was the person who did the vacations on credit cards, et cetera.
Yeah. What I'm trying to get at is, were there conflicts? I understand what you're saying in that you definitely did the best you could with what you had, and I'm sure that they felt torn between the two of you. But yeah. I work with a lot of adult children who felt very much like their parents saw them as nothing more than an extension of them. And so what the parent wanted for them was what they needed. What the parent thought was best was what they needed to do. And then they become adults, and this translates to they think the parent is trying to control them. So like with my daughters, there have been times where I've said things, and then I learned that they thought that was a demand. And I'm like, you've grown and live in your own house. That's not a demand. That was just a suggestion. You can do whatever you want to do. It won't matter to me one way or the other. It doesn't really affect me, but I was just giving a suggestion. I realized I had to actually say that because they were still reacting to me as though they were children, and then projecting onto me that I was treating them like children. So we had to have that conversation. And so I wonder if something, and I've been a part of planning two weddings. Those are stressful. And I remember my mother and I, our experience during my wedding. So, and my sister's two weddings. So it's tough. And so any number of things could happen. But I wonder if at least that second daughter, the second wedding, has difficulty with you, particularly in terms of feeling like you want to control and have your way.
I'm glad you brought that out. Absolutely not, because she planned her own wedding her own way. I let her do her own thing. I wasn't involved unless asked. It was the same with my first daughter, who was married at the young age of 21. They both had the freedom to do what they wanted with and how their wedding was chosen. I've never felt, and I've spoken it all the time, and it was wonderful to hear you speak those words. I was the parent when they were married or when they were dating and having to split themselves among other family members for holiday gatherings.
Yeah.
I would say, let me know what your holiday plans are. When can we get together as a family? Anytime, 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after, so that you're not running around crazy.
You've been flexible, Anne. You have tried to give them a lot of space. If we were to ask your daughter and son-in-law why they aren't talking to you, what do you think they would tell us? Even if it's not true, what would they tell us?
I think they are personally having difficulties in their own marriage. The oldest, at least, who was the closest to me, most like me, I was able, believe it or not, to do as the Spirit led me about 2 years ago. And I took a 2-hour ride to a place that she visits, usually on a Wednesday. And I went down on a Friday night. The Spirit said, Colleen, go visit Tegan at this thrift store. Lo and behold, I pulled into the parking lot, and my eldest and her two sons, ages 5 and 1.5, were there. And I said, this is remarkable. So I spoke with her. I asked if I could give her a hug. She turned to me and said, why are you ambushing me here?
Oh.
And I pointed to the ceiling. I said, God sent me. Don't you always come to this store on Wednesdays? Why are you here on Friday? And she responded, because my oldest forgot to get his Frisbee. So we just ran in and ran out. And I'm like, that's a God moment. So we left, and I thought that would be the end of it. I got hugs from the boys, screaming, hugging me, kissing me, lovely. And she said, you want to get in the truck and talk? And we talked for 2 hours. And I said two things. I didn't know if I'd get another opportunity. Mm-hmm. At that point, it was 1.5 years into to the silent treatment. And I said, can I ask just two questions? I'm not ready to talk to you. And she turned away from me in the driver's seat of the truck, the van. And I said, did I do something to you that I'm not aware of that I could take responsibility for? Or have I not done something that you wished I did? And her response was, it's not about you, Mom. And she wouldn't talk anything further.
Oh, that is so mysterious. You did a great attempt to try to get information that you could work with. That ambushing, you're ambushing me. It sounds kind of similar to the last call, that maybe that doesn't belong to you, but it is worth looking into. If your daughters have struggled with the level of involvement you so generously do want to have while still being really flexible, sometimes they may have felt like it was too much, which doesn't really make sense to me on the surface. But if I were you, I would prayerfully consider, how would my daughters ever have felt like I ambushed them? And what we find is that sometimes when we share our spirituality with our children, it can feel like too much for them, even if they're also believers. So your right answer of God sent me, I would wonder if that felt like too much spirituality. Your daughter said, I'm not ready to talk to you. So perhaps they've needed even more space than the flexibility that you have already given them. Because they're not talking to you, we tend to recommend that you get into your own individual counseling and ask that counselor, how could they ever feel ambushed by me? And by telling some of the stories of what you have been through, we tend to find some signs of, well, it doesn't look like ambushing from our perspective, but why did they feel that way? That's where the exploration has to take place.
I want to read something to you. I've been studying this Thomas Theorem, thought from 1928. And basically it's this statement that if people define situations as real, they're real in their consequences. So it doesn't even matter what happened. She said it's not about you. And so I would take that as true and not make it about you. That is her truth. And so now you can step back and go, okay, well, this isn't about me. Let me pray for my daughter because she's going through something and doesn't feel like I'm a person she can talk to about it. And I would definitely be praying about the spiritual aspect, because a lot of times that's the thing and they don't think that they can have that conversation with their parent.
And leading with strengths of all the good you have done, it doesn't always help to break through defensiveness. Mm-hmm. So looking for, this is how I was imperfect, that helps more with adult children.
You know, I've been thinking about, there's a saying that you hear pretty often. You guys are probably pretty familiar with it. It says, we are human beings, we're not human doings.
Yes.
And I wanted to reflect on that for a little bit. And specifically, there's a book by Larry Crabb called Connecting, where he expounds on this idea of us being and the idea of belonging, and how when we talk about belonging, inherent in the word is a longing to be, a longing to be human, to be present, to be connected, to be a part of something larger than ourselves. And there's a quote from the book that I love. He says, you know, people experience the life-changing force of healing relationships when something powerful comes out of one and touches something good in another. When something powerful comes out of one and touches something good in another. And I wanted to give us three ideas for how that happens. What are some key ingredients, if you will, for being a part of a healing community? Number one is learning to delight in others, to delight in who they are and what they bring to the table in the same way that God delights in us. Number two is to actively seek what's good in the heart of the other. Recognize their strengths, their passions, their purposes, what God's called them to. See the good in them. And then finally, engage in their pain. Engage with their pain. Recognize that some of their pain is the result of other people's sin toward them. And some of their pain is the result of their own sinful choices. And so engaging with their pain is having compassion and empathy, but also calling them to something more beautiful, something that God has called them to. And so if we can do that, if we can delight in others, if we can actively seek what's good in them, and then if we can engage with their pain, whether it's pain that's caused by others or their own sinful choices, we can be a healing community that helps others fulfill that longing to be.
Mm-hmm.
I love that, JJ. And, you know, so often we're so self-focused, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. We're just looking inward at our own stuff. And yeah. we really need to be other focused as well.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's somewhat easier to engage with someone when something has been inflicted upon them by somebody else. But when it's of their own yes. doing, we might get yes. a little judgy, so to speak.
Oh,
so
yeah.
how do we get
yeah,
away
we
from that?
We want to pull away. Yeah. Like, oh, you get yourself fixed and then I'll re-engage.
Yeah.
You. But that's
yeah.
not we what become a, that's high not and what mighty all of a sudden.
It looks like.
You yeah. got yourself yeah, in this yeah. mess. Nothing I can do about it.
Today, I want to talk about signs of depression and how to manage depression when it's time to get more help. So depression doesn't always begin with a major event like a breakup or loss of a job or death of a loved one. Sometimes it starts as this gradual decline that just seeps in and you don't realize it until one day you just realize, I just feel a little bit different than I used to feel. So maybe you're noticing less joy, maybe days feel heavier. Takes more effort to get through them. You might find your mind distracted with unwanted thoughts. And it could also be things that you were once excited about, things that you once enjoyed, things that energized you. They just don't anymore. Now, depression doesn't always look like deep sadness. Especially in men and teens, it can show up as irritation or just this short fuse. And if you're experiencing all these things, you might catch yourself sleeping more, eating more, or isolating, staying home, just not getting involved, turning down invitations. And that can all lead to this guilt of, you know, I should be doing more. And so these are all signs of depression. Now, depression is, it's not about labeling yourself. It's about paying attention to what your mind, your body, and your heart are actually saying to you. And it's not a character flaw. Many people feel inadequate because they can't think their way out of depression. But that's the whole point with depression, is one of the side effects of depression is negative thinking. It's that hopelessness. It's that self-criticism, loss of motivation. It just leads you to this downward spiral that you just get stuck in. So, I mean, we all have hard days, but depression, it's that persistent feeling that goes on and lasts for days and for weeks. And that's a signal. And signals are meant to alert us to something. They're not meant to shame us, right? They're meant to push us toward reaching out for help. And that's what is going to interrupt the cycle. Now, depression's most effectively addressed through therapy and medication. So medication stabilizes the mood while therapy addresses the root cause for long-term change. And while you could try one or the other, studies consistently show that when you combine the two, you can significantly improve recovery and prevent recurrence. Now, the most common objection I hear about medication is, I want to try this on my own first, or I want to wait until I've tried all the other efforts. But medication is not weakness. Most of us don't think too much about taking a pill for a headache or muscle pain or something like that. And medication for antidepressants work in a very similar way. They just help regulate the brain's natural chemistry. A simple way to picture it is like putting a washcloth over a bathtub so it drains slower. So medication just helps your brain's mood regulate neurotransmitter just stay in that synapse longer, and it gives extra time for that transmitter to connect with other brain signals. And that can take a few weeks. So don't wait until things are really bad. That might just prolong unnecessary pain. Okay. Reaching out for help is not an admission of defeat. It's courage. Yeah. And it's actually, it's wisdom. So if what I'm saying is resonating with you, don't wait until you're overwhelmed. You know, the holidays tend to bring about depression for many people. You're not meant to carry that alone. So support doesn't just make the struggle lighter. It makes healing possible.
Our next two calls focus on trust and trauma. Dr. Alice Benton and Mark Cameron come alongside Mitch as he shares his difficulty in trusting women. Then, Chris Williams and Dr. Jill Hubbard share with Dee about dealing with her fear and anxiety stemming from her childhood trauma.
Mitch, thanks for calling in today.
The reason for my call is I'm having issues trusting women. I've been divorced for 11 years, wife had an affair, and don't trust women.
So you haven't had any relationships since then? You haven't dated anyone? You're just... And when you say you don't trust women, you're talking about not even in dating relationships?
Right. I haven't dated in 11 years.
Okay. Mark?
Yeah. So, Mitch, so how is this impacting your life right now? Is it because you're wanting to date and you don't feel like you can?
I would like to date. I just, like I said, I just have trust issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As you describe some of your experience, your history, that makes sense. Your wife had an affair, and that's a big breach of trust. When we get married, our spouse becomes our new attachment figure for us, and they're our person. And so when there's a breach of trust in that relationship, especially to the depth of an affair, that's a wound. And it creates trauma, betrayal trauma, and we carry that around with us. Have you done any work to work through that? Personal work with a therapist?
I have, and it doesn't seem to help. Mm-hmm. I think for me is the therapy that I get, getting to know more about women, seems that I trust women less by going through the therapy.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a male therapist or a female therapist?
I've had two female therapists. I've had a male therapist as well.
What is the therapy unearthing about your relationship with other women in your life that's worsening your trust in them?
Well, I think it started when with my mom. I didn't trust my mom. Mm. And so I disliked her for her treating me different than my siblings.
Mm.
And I was pretty much the scapegoat out of my siblings. And I think as I was getting older, I realized that I didn't know how to verbally explain it or understand it. And as I was going to counseling, I realized that I didn't trust my mom.
Hmm.
And then I had a big trust issue with women. I mean, I love women. It's just, I don't know how to communicate, I would say, just because I didn't trust my mom. I don't know if that's making sense, but that's kind of what I gathered.
Do you have a relationship with your mom now?
No, I don't.
Is she still alive?
No, she just passed about a month ago.
Mm.
Oh, so you're in grief too?
Yeah.
And
well, I don't really know. I would say this. I didn't go to my mom's funeral.
Okay.
And the reason why is because. The reason why is because I was sad, not because I lost my mom. I was sad because I didn't have a mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sometimes that's how grief plays out for us. Sometimes we grieve the relationship that we didn't have, that we wanted to have, that we actually should have had. And so it sounds like you are still shut off from some of those emotions. And, you know, we get to a higher level of emotional intelligence when we can realize how our past is actually impacting us in our present. So you've had these two important female attachment figures who have wounded you deeply, and those don't get separated in our mind. They actually get joined together. And as you had explained earlier on, you didn't know how to verbalize it. But as we learn to put story to our experiences, our brain starts to integrate. And it starts to move memories around. And so that's why therapy, particularly when we explore our past experiences, is very helpful. Even though we're just talking about it, something is actually biologically happening in our brain. And so I would suggest, continuing along that same path with a therapist, exploring, putting more language to how you were hurt by your mother. But then we also need to re-experience. We need to have a new experience to override the old experience. And so that's why if you do have a female therapist, you can learn to build trust with that person. And that way your brain can start to differentiate and say, okay, this person who was a female was harmful to me over here, but now I'm starting to have new experiences with another female over here, and those are healthy. And as you learn to have more of those in the present, those can start to override the painful trauma that you've had. And I would start with a female therapist. I mean, it sounds like you have had one in the past. Did you feel like you built a strong connection and trust with that person or those people?
I've had two in the last 5 years.
How long did you stay with him?
Probably about two to three years.
So you had a significant amount of work with him. That's good.
Oh, I've been in therapy for probably 10 years.
You're experiencing something about how in therapy, it feels like we get worse before we get better.
Mm.
Because your broken trust, it's like a broken bone that was not set correctly. It healed, but it partially healed. And that broken bone, in order to fix it, sometimes it needs to be rebroken and an infection cleaned out and then reset. And then to get your arm strong, you have to add stress to your healing arm to rebuild the muscle around the bone. Therapy is like that, where you have to go back in identifying those wounds, cleaning them out by talking about them and processing, which it sounds like you did a lot of. You're probably now in that adding in healthy stress stage to now rebuild the trust. But because your mother passed away so recently, it's like the broken bone was re-injured. Even if it was a relief in a strange way for her to pass away, it did reveal more of the neglect and the way she had mistreated you. It brought it back up to the surface for you again. The way to get through pain is to keep processing and re-entering with a guide. If we avoid it, it grows in the background. And so adding that stress in, like the muscle around the bone, it's by purposefully entering into interactions with women to rebuild how you both have your radar system, how you identify who are safe people and who are not, and then how quickly you share information, become vulnerable or not. And you need the guidance of the therapist to do that. I really think a structured co-ed group would help you as well, so that you're in a therapeutic environment for the purpose of testing out trust, but under the guidance of a group clinician.
So if he went to a group, though, a co-ed group, like you said, and if would he verbalize this right away that I don't trust women? And then all of a sudden the women and that are in the group might say, oh, well, I got to, you know, watch what I say.
I would reframe slightly to say I'm here because I want to try to figure out how to trust. And I struggle with that.
OK.
And it's by putting yourself in those social situations, doing little tests of revealing, letting your guard down, talking a little bit, but again, under guidance, that you learn to do what your mom was supposed to teach you to do, but she wasn't able to. Instead, she treated you like the scapegoat.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry for all this pain that you've been through. And I'm proud of you, Mitch, that you haven't given up on trying to trust women again, because you realize there's something missing in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one thing that I've noticed is women that I'm attracted to that I would want to go on a date, I don't pursue that. But as far as women that I'm not attracted to, I'm okay. And the reason why I wanted to share the two examples is that I don't make eye contact with those women that I'm attracted to. I avoid them like the plague.
So that's another part of your life to add in healthy stress. With your therapist's help, there was a book that we used to have, How to Get a Date Worth Keeping. We don't keep it in our New Life store any longer, but it sets out such a great path of how to slowly but surely increase your exposure in non-sexualized ways to women to increase your confidence and your courage, even just by talking to an attractive woman at a Starbucks that you wouldn't date. But by having a little experience like that, you build up the muscle of your ability to make eye contact and to talk more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and what you're explaining there, Mitch, is what Alice said about the bone healing, but not in the wrong way. It's, you know, it's a good analogy, but it's not really healed. What happens is you develop a coping strategy to move forward. And that's, you know, what you're explaining there is somebody who you would be attracted to. It feels too vulnerable. So you don't make the eye contact so that you don't get invited into a relationship and then get let down. And that's probably something that you learned early on, maybe with your mother, to not make eye contact with her so that you could stay under the radar and not be wounded. I think How We Love would be a great resource for you if you don't have that book and you haven't read it.
The eyes really are a window to the soul. And when the soul has been hurt, avoiding eye contact is soul protection. But now it's time to update your system and figure out where that healthy stress can be allowed in.
Dee in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on WNIV. Welcome to New Life Live.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. How can we help you today?
Well, my question is, how do I deal with this? I feel like I get traumatized when I'm not... well, it has to do with time frame. So when I'm not meeting the time frame of getting something done or being somewhere on time, I get very fearful and anxious to the point I feel like, hate to say as a child, going back to childhood, I'm about to get the worst spanking or whipping I ever got. And I'm a senior, but it still raises up that fear that I'm not performing. And I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and I can't get there on time. I can, but I'm nervous and anxious. Even in my cooking or my baking, anything that I have to do with the structure of getting it right and being there on time, I get so fearful and nervous. And anxious about getting this whipping or this beating that I'm going to get if I don't get it right and get it done on time.
Well, wow. you wouldn't fear getting whipped and beaten if you weren't whipped and beaten. Is that correct?
I was as a child.
That's my point. That's my point. Okay. So here's the thing. Trauma lives in Einsteinian time. And what that means is that it's relative. Mm-hmm. Time is relative, whereas the rest of our life is lived in Newtonian time, which is linear. So trauma, they would think, oh, well, it was in the past. No, that's not how it works. Mm. That's not how it operates. It operates currently. Our unresolved, unhealed pain stays with us. And so, Dee, you're right on this.
Let me just add another way to look at it, Dee, is that every age you've ever lived is still inside of you.
And so
when the feelings get stirred up and it feels familiar and you have felt this before, right, it taps into those younger ages. And so you're getting when there's pressure, see, there's pressure for time, there's pressure to perform. So you're getting completely dysregulated and you are really operating from a much younger place than your chronological age.
And a great way to differentiate that is what I refer to as troubled energy. If I feel like I'm getting in trouble, that is childlike energy. Because adults don't get in trouble. Adults make decisions and deal with the consequences. Children get in trouble. So what that points to is that there is childhood trauma that needs treatment, that needs care, that needs a healing process for you to be able to work through. And I want to mention one other thing that happens in childhood trauma, especially where physical abuse, well, any form of abuse is used to regulate a child in the extreme form, is that what the child learns is that for me to be okay in the world, I have to be good. If I'm bad, it's called the good bad split. If I'm bad, then I'm not okay. And so we spend our whole life trying to be good or right. But
right.
And then if I'm right, I'm okay. If I'm wrong, I'm not okay.
But it's like a teeter-totter. You're constantly on the balance of falling to either side.
I can't think of something more anxiety-ridden than that.
Right.
So, anxiety disorder is definitely going to be there in that case. But underneath all of that, and this is the heart and soul of our gospel message, is that we're not trying to be good or right, even though we are. We're trying to be loved. And when we're loved, it's much easier to access what is good and right.
Because when we're anxious and fearful, we can't even think.
No.
Let alone perform.
Yeah. The best part of our brain is offline. Our prefrontal cortex can't be reached because our limbic is on fire.
And my daughter told me, she says, you're not getting in trouble. What's wrong? You need to deal with something. You're not getting in trouble. And I hate to tell her, but she reminds me of my mother so much. I'm thinking about to get in trouble.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dee, the first thing I want you to do is to get into some trauma therapy. I think that would be really, really important. In fact, actually, that's a month. Get into trauma therapy today.
Yeah.
If you can.
Because I'm a therapist. I'll keep looking.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And we're connected, with a nationwide network of therapists. And so we can help connect you to a good Christian therapist in your area.
For sure.
Two short teachings remain this month. We all need the courage to take the next step this year in our relationships, our many upcoming challenges, and there will be some, and our own healing journey. Chris gives us a call to courage. I think it's just what we need as we start the new year. And then Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer and Jim Burns remind us that God is our number one cheerleader. I hope I don't have to remind you that New Life is also your cheerleader. We're here for you.
The confession today is, I'm a coward. And so,
Chris.
I know, like it sounds
oh,
harsh.
Now it makes
and
so much sense.
It's all coming together. Yes. So what I mean by that is I truly believe we all have fear and cowardice in us. And this came to light for me because I have a couple of clients, one on the consulting side, one on the therapy side. And these particular guys are facing unbelievable amounts of threats and challenges and struggles that is testing their ethics, mm-hmm. their faith, that is even testing their livelihood. Wow. And over and over and over, they just keep taking one more step of courage. And I sit back mm-hmm. and I honestly get this front row seat where I feel like I'm the one. And this is the other confession, is that us therapists, at least me as a therapist, oftentimes learn as much from my clients as they will ever learn from me. Mm-hmm. Because each of these guys in their own ways, in their own situations, just keep taking one more step of courage forward. Mm-hmm. Even when the last step of courage didn't work out. And it just keeps baffling me. And I keep marveling at it and thinking and putting myself in that situation is and asking myself, would you be able to make these courageous decisions in the face of such imminent threat?
Right.
And this has just kind of led me down to, you know, a deeper aspect of so many different areas of my life where I tend to be a guy who's a conflict avoidant, who wants to just keep the peace and not stir the pot. And so even when something needs to be said or conviction needs to show up or a decision needs to be made, I'm constantly weighing the costs. And not that that's a bad thing. But where it can be at fault is that fear oftentimes gets the mm-hmm. final say, rather than what is right, what is good, what is godly, and ultimately what is courageously necessary. And so I just find that we, you know, now that I look around and I'm like, oh, so many of us remain quiet or remain hidden or go along with something that is contributing to something that's harmful or something that's evil or something that's just not right or not good mm-hmm. simply because of our cowardice. And I'm just reminded of God's command to Joshua when he's about to enter the promised land. And three different times in the first chapter of Joshua, it says, do not fear, mm-hmm. followed by be strong and courageous.
Well, that's a good point. But I think that you mentioned that these guys are courageous in the face of things not working out. And I think we're called to courage. God gives it to us when we need it. And it's not based on the outcome.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Whether it's the right thing or not to do.
Yeah. Right? We're not guaranteed the outcome.
No.
Of it.
And that's what we want. And that's what we're afraid of. And so we sink and we trust our fear over what we know that God is telling us to do.
Well, I oftentimes say this, faith is a risk. If there's no risk, don't call it faith.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good point.
Did you hear that in his voice, though? It was like, hey, there's Jim. And then there's Sherry.
Okay, but this is the thing. Do you know that's how God sees us every day?
Yeah, I think
there
so
is
too.
A wow. And I'm not just trying to spiritualize this.
Right.
Honestly, there is a wow in God's voice every single morning when we get up.
I love that. It's funny.
Excitement.
You know, my background was youth ministry, and somebody came up to me who looked about my age. So they said, I've never forgotten that you said God gives you a standing ovation every morning. I didn't remember saying that as a speaker. I went, that's good. I'm going to use that again.
Yeah.
But I love that God gives us a standing ovation every day. He's happy to see us.
Happy.
And you know,
excited.
And that isn't fast. You know, that's fascinating because a lot of times we think God is mad at us just because maybe our parents were mad at us or our spouse was mad at us or our kids are mad at us. They were mad 24/7 sometimes. But how interesting that God is happy, like you said, to see us.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting in light of that, you're making me think. I think a lot of us think that God's not there. God is distant from us. Right. Like he's so mad
right.
that he's gone to his own bedroom and he's
right.
ignoring you.
Right.
Like some of us grew up with parents
yeah.
or family members when they're mad. Some of us are getting ready to go into the holidays here and we have family members
right.
that are so mad at us right now
right.
Mm. that they're not even talking to us.
Yeah.
We're not even sure, are we going to be together?
Right.
Or maybe you're mad, right? Because something's mm-hmm. happened to you
right.
and you're in your own room, right? So because of these human things that we do that ultimately we're trying to protect ourselves, but we distance ourselves from others, we project that onto God. And
right.
we think that God's that way too, but it's not true. God is always leaning in.
No.
He'll run 1,000 miles.
Right.
He'll run 1,000 miles to come and get you
yeah.
and to be there for you. No matter what you're facing, no matter what you're going through, and really, even no matter what deep sinkhole of sin that you're in, like if you're
yeah.
really struggling and you're in a really deep place of
right.
Acting out, I've seen God run 1,000 miles to those of us
no,
that
really,
are
that's
you
really,
know, really suffering and hurting and acting out and doing all these
yeah.
things.
You know, I was talking to a person, and this is more your field than mine, but a person who had been sexually abused, frankly. And I said, you know what the shortest verse in the Bible is? And they said, no. I said, it's Jesus wept. And I said, I think Jesus weeps for you.
Yeah.
And tears welled up in my eyes. They just did again. But they welled up in her eyes because she saw that, yeah, it's the same God who runs toward us and is happy to see us, but also the same God who mourns some of the pain that we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's heartbroken,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he knows everything that we're doing when we think we're doing it and no one's watching.
Yeah.
Do you know what? He sees us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like a lovesick heavenly father, he's just like, son or daughter, this breaks my heart
right.
because I know it's breaking you.
Yeah.
I know it's hurting
yeah,
you and
so
those
good.
Around you.
It's so awesome to think, you know, our God never sleeps, but it's right. like he was up that morning before we were, and
yeah.
he says, good morning.
Let me tell you about some upcoming events. Every Man's Battle will be January 23 through 25 in Irvine, California, and February 28th, we're going to do an online version. Intimacy and Marriage is February 13 through 15 in Orange County, California. Maybe that's the new thing that you do this year, is you invest in your marriage. Upcoming webinars for 2026 will start in January on January 15th with Break Free from Depression, Tools to Reclaim Your Life. And that'll be Dr. Jackie Mack Harris presenting. We'll also hear from Laura Manja McDonald on February 26th, From Pain to Peace, Healing After Betrayal. I also want to encourage you, we're going to continue with our Zooms, our Club New Life Zooms in the new year. Our first one will be February 3rd with Jim Burns, and stay tuned for some more details. We'll be in touch. You know, as we look at a new year, we can feel overwhelmed because things haven't changed, or we can be overwhelmed because we want so much to change. One thing I know for sure is that God is our ever-present help in our time of trouble. We're not too far away from Christmas and celebrating the best gift that was ever given to us in Jesus Christ. Let's make 2026 our best year yet. Let's lean into what God has for us. Let's make a decision to read the Word each week. I would even challenge you each day. And see what God is asking for you to do to help someone else know about the hope of a transformed life. Thank you for all you do to help us do the work of new life. God bless you and Happy New Year.